So last time, a few of you were absent, and I started out with an introduction to both Aristotle on the soul and Rupert Sheldrake on morphogenesis. So tonight I'm going to continue both of those things. And it last week was very introductory in a way. So tonight we'll go more deeply into Aristotle's conception of what mind is. In a philosophy of evolution course that focuses on the evolution of mind, we need to have some conception of what mind is. And philosophy has been preoccupied generally with that question since its beginning. Philosophy is actually the contemplation of what mind is. So the mind contemplating what it is the meaning of philosophy. And I didn't discover that until I had studied philosophy for about 30 or 40 years. I thought that philosophy was supposed to discover what truth is. But I found out that it's just a study of what the mind is. And I found that a very interesting discovery, actually. So whether you're reading Aristotle 2,400 years back, or Kant and Hegel 200 years back, or someone today who considers themselves an analytical philosopher, Carnap or Dennett, what they're always discussing is what the mind is, how it works, what its limits are, what it can know, what it cannot know, how it can know what it knows. That's really all that philosophy has ever tried to do. And the two fundamental questions that mind asks itself are, what does it know and how does it know it? So, that's been going on since mind became predominant in the human species. And in the beginning, I think probably the beginning is pretty much where we are on this screen here. In early Greece, philosophy became formal. And about the same time in India, the Yoga Darshanas and all the Darshanas were written, sort of 500 to 1000 BC. And the approach that they took at that time was quite similar. So there are texts from India during that period on logic and how the mind knows what it knows and what it knows as a result of how it knows. And so that was the philosophic period. That's when it began, also in China. There are many texts from that period of about 500 BC in China, the Confucian texts and the Neo-Confucian texts, which are all about mind. So it's not bad to start with Aristotle, because, as I said last time, he describes pretty accurately the way we think. And you can recognize it quite easily, I believe. So last time we discussed the fundamental concepts of form and matter. And Aristotle described form and matter as the potential and actual, what is and what, how what is gets to be what it is, how the matter of something becomes the form that we know. And he describes this as a process of nature. And he says that nature never does anything without a purpose. So the form is the purpose or the final actualization of something, and that's what we know. And the material substratum is potentially what the thing is. And so we'll see some examples of that tonight. The acorn becomes the tree, and we don't worry about understanding the tree from the acorn. We understand that the acorn is going to become something quite different, and that's going to be the thing. The essence of the thing is the tree. And we know essences. According to Aristotle, that's what we know. We don't know the matter of something, we know its form or its essence. So let's then, he described the three levels of the soul. And everything which has a form has a soul, which helps it to become that form. And he described three different levels of soul. The nutritive, which is the growing aspect, how the physical living thing becomes what it is meant to become. It does that through nutrition and growth and reproduction and so on. In other words, the vital soul. And then he described the sense perception soul, perception, and all animals have that. And that distinguishes animals from plants. And then he described the intellective soul, the soul that thinks. So for him, soul is the nature of everything which enables it to become what it is. Soul is there in the matter, and it brings the form into its actual, from its potential material state. So now we're focusing on the third level of soul, which is the intellective soul or mind. So I just want us to become familiar with the basic concepts as articulated by Aristotle. And these concepts can be tools that we use to better understand what mind is. That's all. I mean, Aristotle can't tell us what mind is, but he can give us some tools that we can use to figure out for ourselves what mind is. Just like Sri Aurobindo gave us those Vedantic tools, citta and manas and buddhi. So similarly, now Aristotle is going to give us some tools. He says, turning now to the part of the soul with which the soul knows and thinks, whether this is separable from the others, that is to say, from the sensational and nutritional part of the soul, whether it can be separated from those in definition only or spatially as well, whether the mind can be separated from the body only by definition, or whether it can actually be materially separated from the body, we have to inquire, in order to know this, number one, what differentiates this part, mind, from the others, and two, how thinking can take place. How is it possible for mind to know something? If thinking is like perceiving, it must be either a process in which the soul is acted upon by what is capable of being thought, or a process different from but analogous to that. The thinking part of the soul must therefore be, while impassible, passive, capable of receiving the form of an object. That is, must be potentially identical in character with its object without being the object. He went through a description just before this of what perception is. And he says the sense perception, hearing for example, is identical with its object. Sense perception is nothing until it hears the sound. And when it hears the sound, it is that sound that it is hearing. Somehow the sound and the perception of the sound are identical. Somehow, when we see that, what we register is that. You're not seeing an image of that when you're looking at it, you're seeing that. So that somehow is perceived by sight. And this sound that you're hearing coming from me, you are resonating with at the moment when I'm speaking. And so your hearing faculty is somehow possessing this sound that you're hearing, and your mind is somehow understanding what it is that's being said. So when I say that, you know I'm indicating this whiteboard with those images on it. So sense perception, he says, mind, he says, must work somehow similar to the way sense perception works. The form of objects, what they mean, what they are, you're looking at me, so who I am, what I am, my presence here, is somehow understood by you. So just like the sight is something that enables you to see me, you have an understanding of me as the person who is making this presentation to you, and you understand that perfectly well because I am the person making the presentation to you. So you understand what is in front of you with your mind just like you understand what is in front of you with your eyes. And there is apparently no mediation taking place. What you're not thinking right now, you're not reflecting much about what you see and what you hear and what you know, you are simply seeing and hearing and knowing. So Aristotle is asking the question, how is it that mind knows these objects, these forms, but it doesn't consume them like eating food? It doesn't possess their matter, it somehow possesses their essence. You know me here making this presentation to you as me making this presentation to you. You don't become, I don't become somehow in your being in order for you to know me, but still you know me. So mind is able to know the form that presents itself to the mind. So he asked the question, how? How does that happen? If thinking is like perceiving, it must be either a process in which the soul is acted upon by what is capable of being thought, and he said last time that what is capable of being thought is the essence of objects. We are able to think about objects without eating them, and what we think about them is what they are. So the mind is acted upon in some way by what is. So it must be capable of receiving the form of an object if it is analogous to sense perception. Now that's a big if. But this is the Aristotelian point of view. Mind is analogous to sense perception from the Aristotelian point of view. Therefore, since everything is a possible object of thought, everything that exists is a possible object of thought, mind, in order, as Anaxagoras says, to dominate, that is, to know, to master, must be pure from all admixture. It must not be affected by temperature and by pleasant sensations and by grossness and subtlety. It must be pure without admixture. For the co-presence of what is alien to its nature is a hindrance and a block. This sounds almost yogic. Mind has to become pure and detached in order to know really what is. Otherwise it gets mixed up with vital impulses and opinions and so on. It follows that it too, like the sensitive part, can have no nature of its own, other than that of having a certain capacity. In other words, mind is potentially knowing whatever is. Thus, that in the soul which is called mind, by mind I mean that whereby the soul thinks and judges, is before it thinks not actually any real thing. Just like sight and hearing, he says, are in themselves not anything except potentially seeing and hearing. Only when they're activated by light or by sound do they come into being, the senses. The senses are passive. They receive objects. So mind also, he believes, is passive. It simply receives objects, but not the objects themselves, the essence of the objects. For this reason, it cannot reasonably be regarded as blended with the body. Now, this idea has dominated Western science ever since Aristotle said these words. The mind must be separate, must not be mixed up with the body. It may use sensations and emotions to build, to reflect on and build upon, but in itself it is separate. So there's Descartes for you, right there. Descartes was a major Aristotelian, as were all of the medieval philosophers.
Excuse me, but then he means really something else by a real thing when he says it's not actually a real thing. He says it's not actually a real thing, and then it comes to this conclusion.
But later on it will become a real thing. But let's don't jump to that yet. I mean, I'm going to get there in a minute. It cannot be regarded as blended with the body. If so, it would acquire some quality, e.g. warmth or cold, or even have an organ like the sensitive faculty, an eye, the eye of the mind. As it is, it has none. It was a good idea to call the soul the place of forms, though this description holds only of the intellective soul. So the nutritive soul is not the place of forms. Where did my mouse go? Okay, it's there. The nutritive soul is a place for food, and it's completely combined with the body, he said. The soul and the body, as far as the nutritive faculty goes, are blended. The soul and the body, as far as perception goes, are blended. But the soul and the body, as far as mind goes, are not blended. Two, even this is the forms only potentially, not actually. So the soul is the place of forms potentially. It's not actually the place of forms, the forms are where they are. So, observation, let's see, did I want to read this? No, I don't want to read that. I want to go to the next page, which is...
You say it's the quality of the essence of the soul. Is it the energy or is it the light?
Well, we will see. We'll see. Let's let Aristotle tell us. Right. That's right. It has no quality.
No, it has no quality.
And in that's why in you know Buddhism also came up at about this time. And in Buddhism, if you contemplate pure mind, it is emptiness, and it is the essence of everything. But in itself, its pure nature is emptiness. So,
I think that's quite an important point.
I think all of these points are important, yeah. So here, let's go to this comment here. He says, since in every class of things, as in nature as a whole, we find two factors involved, a matter, which is potentially all the particulars included in the class. Okay, notice here's classes of things. We know classes of things, right? We don't know things themselves. We know classes. We know people, we know lions and giraffes, we know politics, societies, we know classes. And we know the particulars that belong to those classes, right? But those particulars of those classes are still what we call concepts. They are abstractions. They're what Conrad Lorenz called constancy phenomena. We recognize societies as such, but we are not looking at all of the cells and organs and emotions and behaviors of the society when we think of the society of Athens in 2350 BC. We have a whole bunch of things that we combine in that concept, but what we mainly know is that the society of Athens in 2300 BC was not the society of Bodh Gaya in 2350 BC, and it was not the society of Ur in 2800 BC. It was what it was, and that's what we know, what it was. We don't know all the nitty-gritty details, but we know the essence of it. That, according to Aristotle, is the way the mind works. And he's absolutely right. And that's why we have to evolve beyond it. Last night I read a very trenchant deconstruction of this Aristotelian conception of mind by Henri Bergson. He completely destroyed this conception of mind in his evolutionary philosophy. But why do that? We'll see. It has limits. It has very serious limits. Every class of things is made up of a matter, which is potentially all the particulars included in the class, and a cause, which is productive in the sense that it takes them all the material, like art does with its material. These distinct elements must likewise be found within the soul. Let's see, it looks like I'm missing something. It makes them all. A cause which is productive in the sense that it makes them all. Okay, so the cause of something makes it out of all of the material. Any form that we know has both the matter in it and a cause or soul which makes it be what it is. So, in fact, mind, as we have described it, is what it is. Somehow there are two of those there. By virtue of becoming all things, while there is another which is what it is by virtue of making all things. This is a sort of positive state, like light. For in a sense, light makes potential colors into actual colors. Mind, in this sense of it, is separable, impassible, unmixed, since it is in its essential nature activity. For always the active is superior to the passive factor, the originating force, to the matter which it forms. So mind makes everything, or mind becomes everything. Let's just put it that way. Mind can become everything. Mind can cause everything to be what it is. Actual knowledge is identical with its object. So the mind becomes that object, that collection of words which have meaning. Our minds become that while we are considering those words. or these concepts which I'm communicating. Mind becomes those. Mind in itself, before it becomes those, is potentially all of these forms that we are communicating, but actually none of them, but potentially all of them. So mind is like a field that potentially knows everything that exists. As such, Aristotle conceives of it as also being the cause, the final cause of everything that exists. So mind in the individual is potentially whatever exists in its conception. But mind in its universal aspect is the cause of everything which exists. And so the soul in each individual is what makes that individual become what it is. And the reason the soul is able to do that is because it has this intellective aspect, or this mind aspect, which is ultimately the cause of everything. Therefore, our mind is able to know what is, because it is the essence of what is already. It is already the essence of everything that is, and when it comes into contact with something that is, then it becomes that, which it already was potentially, because it was from the beginning potentially everything. And like light, actively present in the universe, creating everything that is. Actual knowledge is identical with its object in the individual. Potential knowledge is in time prior to actual knowledge. So potentially you know everything that I'm telling you, but you only get to know it actually as a result of me telling it to you. So the potential was there in time prior to me telling you all of these things, right? But now I have told you all of these things, so you actually know them. But in the universe as a whole, knowledge is not prior, even in time. Potential knowledge is not prior, even in time. In other words, all knowledge is actual already in the mind of the universe. It is potential only in the individual souls until it becomes actual. But in the universe as a whole, knowledge is always actual. And because mind is like light, illuminating form, but not just visible form, but the whole organic process of becoming is being caused by actual mind, which holds everything on the plane of knowledge, but not on the plane of matter. It's pure mind, not mixed. Mind is not at one time knowing and at another not. When mind is set free from its present conditions, It appears as just what it is and nothing more. This alone is immortal and eternal. And without it, nothing thinks. So, mind is a universal presence capable of knowledge in the individual soul, but possessing all knowledge in itself, in its universal, on its universal plane. So let's think about this cosmologically in relation to Sri Aurobindo. There is matter, there is life, there is mind. Aristotle just defined, there's the matter, which is potentially what the form is. There is the nutritive soul, which brings it into its living form. And there is the mind, which gives it its purpose, which is what we know when we know something. We know its essence, its purpose, its meaning.
How it was possible that the aboriginals, when the ships from Columbus and others came to their place and they didn't know ships, were not able to perceive what was there, even if it was there outside of them? This is a
good question.
They
did know that it was there outside them. They didn't know its history, and they didn't know where it came from, but they knew the object there, full of people. So they knew something about it, and then after some time they knew more about it, and finally they knew the whole ugly truth. Oh, I don't think that's true.
I've always heard that.
Because according to Aristotle, if it's there in front of you, you see it. You may not know what it is exactly, because you're just perceiving it. That's his point. So at first it was just a sense perception, but not one that they could categorize. But after some time, they could categorize it.
Because
they couldn't see the spot in the water?
No. Well, it's just that it didn't, because it had no meaning at all, it didn't exist.
Well,
that's a
speculation.
So
no one could know that.
No, I mean, that was the report. I've read that.
Well, yeah, but no one could actually know that. That must be the report of an archaeologist who reached that conclusion as a result of his pipe full of ayahuasca or something.
I'm not the only person who's heard it.
No, I've heard it also, but it's a speculation, that's all. And all of our knowledge is just speculation, anyway. What do we know about history, about anything that actually happened in history? We know what we construct on the basis of information that we gather. And we construct a picture that's more or less meaningful to us. So, and after we construct that picture, then we reach all kinds of conclusions that aren't based upon anything except that construction. So, anyway, let's go on here a little bit more. Let us summarize our results about soul and repeat that the soul is in a way all existing things. For existing things are either sensible or thinkable, and knowledge is in a way what is knowable, and sensation is in a way what is sensible. In what way, we must inquire. Knowledge and sensation are divided to correspond with the realities. Potential knowledge and sensation answering to potentialities, actual knowledge and sensation to actualities. So before we smell the smell, it's potential, and after we smell it, it's actual. And if it was there, we would smell it, and when it's not there, we don't smell it. So, within the soul, the faculties of knowledge and sensation are potentially these objects, the one what is knowable, the other what is sensible. They must be either things themselves, they must be either the things themselves or their forms. The former alternative is, of course, impossible, because the mind can't be the thing that it knows, it just simply knows the essence of it. The smell can't be the incense, it just smells the scent which comes through the air. It is not the stone which is present in the soul, but its form. It follows that the soul is analogous to the hand, for as the hand is a tool of tools, so the mind is the form of forms, and sense the form of sensible things. Now, we shouldn't forget that we heard last time that the form of sensible things is the final cause also of the sensible thing. The form is the essence. So the incense produces fragrant smoke because that is its purpose. The animal produces offspring and builds houses and habitats for its offspring because that is its purpose. So what we sense and what we know is what is. That's what Aristotle says. It is, sense and knowledge are what is. And here's an interesting one. He says, mind is always right, but appetite and imagination may be either right or wrong.
So I don't believe what we, what mind is, in front of mind.
When it's pure mind, what it knows is what is. It can be clouded by imagination and sensation, appetite, what drives the person to do what they do or the animal to do what it does. The appetite, he says finally, appetite is a cause of motion, and mind is also a cause of motion. And appetite is the cause of a temporal motion which has to do with growth and the achievement of objects. But mind causes motion in the sense of the final cause. Without moving itself, without becoming something, it is able to move things. So, for example, the inclination to select a passage here and give it to you is something that my hand does because my mind decided that that was important. So this presentation is possible because mind itself can move the human being to do things. Without itself being moved by some other cause. So this goes back to his philosophy of physics, that there must be a cause which itself is not caused. And that's why he concludes that it's mind. Because at that stage of philosophy, The farthest that the greatest mind was able to go was here, to conclude that there is something that knows, and that that something itself knows what is, and therefore it is also the cause of what is, without itself being caused by any other thing. So now we get into metaphysics. In the philosophy of evolution, we ask the question, are all of the forms and processes that we now understand from all the scientific sources and philosophical sources that we have explored, are those forms and processes enough in themselves to explain the phenomenon known as evolution? Natural selection, adaptation, variation as a result of changes in the environment, the inheritance on the genetic level, on the epigenetic level, on the behavioral level, and on the symbolic level, all the processes that lead to the formation of habits, the maintenance of those habits until it's no longer possible for the species to survive, and then it begins to acquire other habits, and then through behavior and through mutation, new species are formed. And so we can describe this whole process today, especially since the 1960s, when plate tectonics were discovered, and when it was discovered by physicists that the universe itself evolves. So we now know that none of these forms that we know are themselves permanent, but we are able to know them abstractly to a very great extent. And we're able to describe all of the processes that underlie evolution. To quite a great extent. So, knowing what we know, is anything else required to satisfy us that we understand the process and that the process itself is what it is? Have we been able to understand it sufficiently? Are we satisfied that we know what it is, how it works? Are all of our questions answered? Paul is shaking his head, so let me ask you then, what question is not answered?
The reasons, roots, and what is behind, because if there is something evolving, it has to have a goal, a cause. And we are between.
There's
a root, a fruit,
okay.
Beginning and end.
Wait. Now, we know that the universe evolves,
yes.
That there is a force that comes from the Great Bang or from whatever, from changes in temperature or magnetic fields or whatever, and that this force has evolved simple life forms which had all their senses. I mean, they had some senses, and then higher life forms which had more senses. And finally, we have human beings who are conscious. So it seems that the purpose was to, first of all, as Aristotle says, for each thing to become what it is, nature was able to select and to vary and to create all the different things that they are and to create a web of life, of the biosphere, and the human being is now there in that biosphere as a result of all of that. and in the human being is conscious. So that we can explain to a large extent the whole process in terms of the evolution of consciousness. You know, if the perception of light was there from the first animalcule, microscopic animalcule, and perception enabled there to be learning, and this kept on evolving until now we have on Earth all kinds of animals with five senses, and the human being with not only five senses but an active mind, conscious of all of these things. It seems that in order to understand the evolution of consciousness, we know everything that we need to know. What is it that we don't know? We know the reason, and we know the result, the end.
But partially, we guess, we suppose, we don't know Big Bang once or many Big Bangs. What would be after pralaya, many pralayas, one pralaya, what is our...
Okay, let me give you a hint at where I'm going with this question. All of the biologists from Darwin up until the present time say that each living thing is maintains itself by habit. And so even Darwin said that habit is basically nature is just habit, and everything maintains itself in its niche by habit. And Lawrence says that these habits that everything has, from the cell to the society, evolved through energy exchanges that constituted information processing systems. So things are able to adapt because they get information about their environment, they create habits in relation to their environment, they reproduce their types from the cell division all the way up to the dance of mating by habit, and the mother agrees that we all maintain ourselves by habit. And so if we take everything that we've learned and put it together, we come to the conclusion that everything is maintained by habit according to the principles of self-reproduction and cognition, cognitive interchanges between the organism and the environment, which reinforce the habits, and cognition itself is a habit. So if everything is what it is as a result of eons of habits being maintained for as long as it's possible to maintain them, and then changing into other habits known as other species, what is it that enables habit itself to constitute an adequate process for maintaining a species in its niche? If cognition is what is happening in the exchange of energy between the organism and its niche, and that cognition enables it to establish a habit because it knows where to go and where not to go and what tastes good and what doesn't taste good and who's warm and who's cold, and so it finds a habitual niche, a pattern of life and death that it maintains by habit as a result of cognition, then one question that can be still asked is, how is it that habit and cognition, conscious interaction with the environment, happen to exist as mechanisms for conscious existence. How is it that sight happens to be a sensation that serves consciousness? How is it that habit conserves consciousness? In other words, if consciousness is the whole purpose of evolution, how does consciousness itself happen to be in existence? Why isn't the whole universe and life on Earth just automatic? Why does it happen to end up as consciousness, which obviously has evolved all the way through the whole life process so that we are conscious? And the first animalcule was conscious on its level of heat at least and light. So how is it that consciousness is somehow the core phenomenon of all phenomena? It's there behind perception, it's there behind habit, it's there behind cognition. Cognition is a form of consciousness, habit is a form of consciousness, perception is a form of consciousness. So consciousness seems to be a principle in the whole process of evolution. Agreed? Now, how is it that consciousness happens to be the principle in the whole process of evolution that seems to have also a driving force in it? Because as Aristotle says, you have potential matter, but the matter somehow becomes a form. So there's a soul there, a cause, something that enables the thing to become what it is instead of to become something else than what it is. So this consciousness that is evolving in matter and life and mind and seems to be a cause, it seems to be not only present in forms and structures, but it seems to be driving those forms and structures to higher and higher levels, and we call it nature. So we go back to Darwin. How is it that nature happens to be selective? And that nature happens to be cognitive? From whence comes the ability of matter to become progressively more conscious? You know the answer. Okay, but then whence comes joy? It's a product, right?
No. It's being, it's consciousness.
The essence.
Yes, because there's no distinction.
Okay, so let me move now quickly to Sheldrake. Sheldrake says, as I read last time, that this whole Aristotelian idea of soul and form has now been assumed by theorists of formative causation. Formative causation is another name for morphogenesis. Morpho is form, genesis is causation. Morphogenesis means formative causation. So he says that physics and biology can observe that there are structures that underlie evolution. DNA underlies evolution. Behavioral patterns underlie evolution. Natural selection is a process that underlies evolution. So then the question is, the essential metaphysical question for Sheldrake is, how is it that habitual, the repetition of habits constitutes cognition? How is it that we learn through repeating things? How is it that learning takes place just as a result of repeating things? No, but that's not the question. Is there any other way? The question is, it is apparent that learning takes place through repetition, and it becomes a preferred pattern, a joyous experience. And so something called cognition takes place through repetition. Something called DNA takes place through repetition. The repetition of cell division and replication from the lowest level to the highest level somehow has happened in a consistent cognitive way. So repetition at the genetic level yields more and more conscious structures. Behavior yields more and more varieties of species. Species repeat themselves until they become other species that are more conscious. So habit somehow and yields cognition, and at the human level we know this through learning. So Sheldrake says, okay, we can observe that learning takes place through repetition, and the birds learn how to take the caps off of the milk bottles, and they pass that information on to each other. And the monkeys learn to stack up the boxes to get the banana because, first of all, they wanted the banana and they got it, and then they didn't get it because it was too high, and they played with boxes, and somehow they figured out that they could stack the boxes, and then they put together the two things, wanting the banana and stacking the boxes, and pretty soon they were standing on top of the boxes getting the banana. So human beings work exactly the same way. And so learning takes place through observation, through repetition, through combinations of trial and error, and then once the learning takes place, it gets passed on to others. So this is conscious behavior. Now, Sheldrake says we can observe that conscious behavior is going on throughout the animal kingdom all the time. And at the human level, it's going on, almost that's all that's going on. Everything else is secondary to that. Question.
Yes, there's a seeming very weird exception there. And I'll be happy to pass around this video, this YouTube video. I saw it just yesterday. There was an autistic young man, and because of that, he is very, very limited, and yet he has an exceptional ability. And what they did, I think he's English, they put him in a helicopter. And he flew over Rome. He's never been to Rome in his life. He doesn't know anything about Roman history, Roman architecture, or anything like that. But he has the ability to remember instantly and thoroughly, and in great detail, everything he sees. He just has this incredible memory. So they do this. They fly him over Rome. Immediately put him into a room with a 5-meter piece of blank paper. And he sits there, and they are very accurately taking the map of Rome and the things and measuring what he drew with what actually is, and he did it. I mean, in front of your eyes, right? Right. Said the video was there.
Yeah, Stephen Gould's son was like that. He could calculate infinitesimal sums in his head, and he was autistic.
Stephen Gould was autistic?
No, his son.
Oh, oh, oh.
And in his books he often writes about his son, who is able to do these incredibly impossible phenomena, but he can't get along in society at all. He can't do the simplest things, but he can do the most impossible things.
Yeah.
So what's your point?
What is the point? I don't know. You're somebody who has, well, there is no repetition in this particular ability.
Yoga.
Yeah, well, but...
No, really.
Like, on the intellectual, I mean, like, through asanas, meditation, do we do more of this stuff? Or?
We went through this in a previous session. Okay, we'll get back to it. Just keep your question in your mind. And if you want to listen to the first three sessions, we were reading a lot about that, exactly that. But now we're going back to biology and philosophy a bit. And so Sheldrake says, well, can we have a theory that explains how cognition works at the cellular level, at the vital behavioral level? At the mental cognitive level, how is it that consciousness occurs at all of those levels, and it's not just automatic, mechanical stuff? At every level, there is some form of consciousness happening. Can we explain how it happens? How does consciousness itself happen at every level? Memory, learning, habit, selection for good and rejection of bad, and so on. So he asks that question from the point of view of a biologist who is very familiar with physics. And he says, evolution occurs at all levels of organization, from atoms to galaxies. At each level of organization, the organized systems, insulin molecules, fruit flies, instinctive patterns, nest building behavior, flocks of birds, tribal societies, scientific theories, all of these are fields, morphic fields. Forms, as Aristotle would say. We know the forms of all of these things. And we know that there are forms within forms, molecules, organs, organisms, societies of organisms, planets, galaxies, forms within forms within forms. The hypothesis of formative causation inevitably implies that the evolutionary process is closely connected with the evolution of morphic fields. There are four major consequences of this view. First, the appearance of new patterns of organization. How does that happen? You know, that's one of those questions. Well, I mean, we can describe how the shrew became the shrew became the hippopotamus and the dolphin, and eventually from hippopotamus and dolphin there became primates who were related to the hippopotamus and the dolphin genetically and behaviorally. We can observe that. But at each level, new forms appeared. And those new forms were not just repetitions of the old forms. They were really novel creations. New kinds of crystals, new classes of organisms, new scientific theories. This appearance of new patterns of cognition is associated with the appearance of new morphic fields. possible creative sources of new fields can be. Perhaps we can find what are the possible creative sources of new fields. These fields are wholes, and precisely because of their irreducible integrity, they have to appear suddenly. Now, this is a great idea. The new form that appears is different from the old form because they are holistic fields. And so they don't occur little by little. The whole new thing occurs at once. So you don't have between the shrew and the tarsier, which is a kind of low-level primate, you don't have an infinite series. You have the shrew and the tarsier. So somehow there's an evolutionary mutation that takes place. There's a gap. Biologists are never able to find out what goes in the gap. So this is because of the holistic nature of evolution. When there's a change in the genetic pattern, it affects the whole organism. So he says that that fields, the nature of fields, helps to explain these leaps between forms in evolution. Of course, new morphic fields, or new species, involve continuity with what went before, as well as discontinuity. All new fields embrace lower-level morphic units that existed prior to their appearance. So, you know, the cell, the molecule, the cell, the organs, this is a whole morphic field. And when the DNA changes it radically, it changes the whole morphic field. And so you get a new species.
What about Gould's theory, though?
No, let's stay with this one. This one is complicated enough. Second, morphic fields are subject to natural selection. The fields of new patterns of organization that are not viable will not be stabilized by morphic resonance. Now, morphic resonance means that this field continues to be what it is because it resonates with what it was yesterday. And what it was yesterday resonates with what it was the day and the year and the millennium before that. So for him, morphic fields maintain themselves through resonance. So the first bird learns to take off the cap, then another bird learns to take off the cap, and then a whole bunch of birds are learning to take off the caps of the milk bottles, and that constitutes a behavior field which maintains itself easily because there are now lots of these birds who do that, instead of just one who does that. And before there was one who did that, there were none who did that. So there was no such field. But once that field came into existence, then it constituted a behavior field. And so once the first molecule came into existence that became DNA, other molecules could copy that molecule. And so my question is, I think you see the picture, right? Morphic fields are identical to actual physical, vital, and mental forms, except that they don't exist in time and space. But they correspond exactly to what does exist in time and space. And so, since all the moments that we know are now, there's all that past and all that future that doesn't exist right now, except in a kind of non-material way. So he says that all of time exists in a non-material way as fields that correspond exactly to what did exist at any particular time. And so there's a resonance on the non-material level. So my question is, number one, how can you have resonance on a non-material level? And number two, since all of these forms actually exist, and they actually learn, and they actually evolve, why do you need morphic fields which are identical to them to explain them? You just keep creating, this is a physicist's obsession, to create a world of subtle forms that are somehow supposed to explain a world of existing forms. And you can't prove that they're there. It's a hypothesis to prove what is there with something which is not there. And there was a very clever medieval philosopher named William of Ockham who was studying Platonic ideas, and he said, why do you need to have an idea of a giraffe in order for there to be a giraffe? No, Aristotle was more clever. Aristotle said you need to have a cause of things which are what they are, which you know because they are what they are. And so the form must have a cause, and that's its soul. And because you know it, and you don't have it in you, you know its essence. And so there must be mind which is able to know something which is in things, but which is not those things themselves. It's their essence. So he concluded that mind is a part of soul which causes things to be on the essential level, while life causes things to be on the vital level, and matter causes things to be on the material level. So he was trying to explain everything in terms of cause, but based upon Plato. But it was, he changed Plato. He didn't say that the forms existed out there in the invisible everywhere. He said the forms exist in the things. And so mind is a principle that goes along with the actual world. It is, in fact, the potential of all the actual world. So now we get Platonic Aristotelian thought transferred by Sheldrake, who is a Catholic philosopher and who is a 20th century biologist. He writes a lot about Plato and Aristotle and Teilhard de Chardin, and he lived with Bede Griffith for 10 years in an ashram in India. And he tried to synthesize the idea of citta, manas, and buddhi with the Aristotelian cosmology. And he came up with morphic fields, which are fields of intelligence, entelechies, according to Aristotle's word, is entelechy, something which is the essence of something which causes it to be what it is. That's its entelechy, or its intelligent soul. So for Sheldrake now, all the intelligent souls of everything are reduced to field theory, systems theory. And now he says that there are these subtle fields which stay in existence forever, and they get stronger and stronger the more and more they're repeated. And this is what enables a species to exist for millennia until it can no longer exist, and then it jumps into another field. But then he says at the end, how it jumps isn't explained by morphic resonance. Only how it maintains itself is explained by morphic resonance. And so the question still remains of creativity. Even after going to all the trouble of creating another world that corresponds to the real world, to explain the real world. So, this is the problem that I wanted to bring to you.
This is how the overmind, overmental being would be created. This is how the supermental being would be created, yes?
By morphic fields?
By the fact that, but mind creates, mind is the creator.
So if we take
by repetitive habit and all of that, it develops this thing and then suddenly boom.
Okay, if we give Aristotle an Aurobindian interpretation, and we conclude that what Aristotle really meant by the universal mind was overmind, and what he meant by the mind in the soul, the intellective soul, was rational mind. So if he was having an intuition of supermind, supermind as the eternal radiance of the actuality of everything that is potential, then we can reach the conclusion that consciousness had to evolve because supreme consciousness was there as the radiant source from the beginning.
There is no yet answer for this habit. Describing habit as endurance in the form of a particular kind, a niche or resonance or field,
right,
is not an explanation.
No, it's not. It's an attempt to explain something by creating another set of entities that themselves can't be explained. I mean, what is the difference between saying that supermind created mind, life, and body as an evolutionary complex, and saying that the supermind created morphic fields to create minds, lives, and bodies to provide an evolutionary structure? You don't need, as Occam said, you don't need for supermind to create an extra set of systems or forms in order to have a system of forms. So it seems to me that what Sri Aurobindo is saying when he describes citta, he says that citta is mind. It has memory. It can pull out of matter, because it was always there in the evolution of matter. It evolves with the material form. It evolves with the vital form. And in us, it always remembers everything subconsciously, because it is the principle of mind at the most material level. And it becomes manas at the higher level of evolution, where senses are evolved. The structures of senses have evolved through the function of the citta in matter, and the citta in life, and the citta in mind have produced sensory apparatuses, and those sensory apparatuses have been evolving, manas has been evolving from the beginning to give information, to collect information. That's the principle of manas. It collects information. Why do you have to have another principle to explain manas when manas itself explains the phenomenon? And then you have buddhi, which is rational mind, which is a higher form of citta and manas, that processes information abstractly. Why do you need another principle to explain that principle, which is itself what it is? It's that. So in the end, Sri Aurobindo seems to say that science is able to ask all of these questions and to probe deeper and deeper and measure more and more until it finally will come to the point of having to say that even if there are 11 dimensions of space, instead of 3 or 4 or 13, that is a physical description of the universe. It still doesn't explain, as Roger Penrose loves to say, it still doesn't explain consciousness. So, the fact is, says Sri Aurobindo, that the universe is made up of planes. There's a material plane, and a vital plane, and a mental plane, and many planes of supermind, and that's what it is. And if you do this Buddhistic reduction, and you detach yourself from this analyzing mentality, and the sense mind, and the citta with all of its habits, and you just pull back into Purusha itself, pure mind, then you can find the will to be back there in the very beginning, behind everything, in you. And that will to be becomes the will to be physical, and the will to be vital, and the will to be mental, and ultimately the will to be divine. That psychic being has been there from the beginning, from the first descent into the material universe, and it has evolved its organs of citta and manas and buddhi until finally it is able to step back into its pure self and then to receive the vibrations of its ultimate self and then to begin to evolve a yet higher level of structure corresponding to that ultimate self, while at every level it evolved a system of structures at that level which expressed on that level that ultimate self. So that ultimate self was expressed on the physical level, and it enabled the physical level to create DNA, and then the vital will could use the DNA to create all the forms of life, and then the mental will could use all the forms of life to create mental structures, and then that mental structure becomes conscious enough to reconnect with the self in everything. And that explains what everything is. It is a self-emanation of its potential in infinite varieties on all the planes. And so by becoming conscious of self, one answers all the questions of how habit and how cognition and how nutrition and how ethical decision and how supramental manifestation.
And if five people do this in a collective, what happens?
They turn into the Oroville symbol.
There you go. I mean, just think of the energy that's involved with that.
Or maybe into a flower. They become the flower, but they retain themselves. So, anyway, my point tonight was to explore what the mind is able to do with respect to understanding and describing cause and effect and being and time and form and substance, and this is a, we're, you know, with Aristotle and Sheldrake, we get to a kind of scientific metaphysics. But neither science nor scientific metaphysics answers the ultimate questions. And philosophy is able to show us the limitations of mind at both scientific and metaphysical. And then we come to the necessity to put into play a force of consciousness which is actually able to know from the self the whole, because the whole is nothing other than that self, and it can't know it any other way.
Basically, it explains the phenomenon of endurance or habit. Why habit was necessary?
Yeah.
It has to hold to something which is already conquered on a particular level to build up a psychic foundation.
Until it gets enough of well enough established at that level. And so if you look at the principle of stability, which corresponds to sat, you know, the principle of stability is established in matter, then the principle of stability is established in the genome, and then the principle of stability is established in the phenome, and then it's established in human societies. And so then the next level of establishment of the principle of stability needs to have Gnostic beings.
You said at one point when you were saying that you withdraw and become the Purusha, and you said the mind, then in the few minutes, I mean, the same sentence almost, you said the psychic being.
Right. The Purusha can be used interchangeably. The meaning of it is used interchangeably by Sri Aurobindo, even in the chapters that we've read. There's a mental Purusha and there's a psychic Purusha. So one is a doorway to the other. It is the witness self. So the witness self is essentially the psychic being, and it becomes the self of body and the self of life and the self of mind, and then it comes back to its original self, and it rises above to its overmind self and its supramental self. And so it's, you know, we categorize. That's the problem with the Aristotelian mind, is that we try to latch on to categories which are supposed to correspond to actualities. And then the mind can become everything, right? So it becomes all of these forms, and then it's stuck to its definition. And oh, if that definition doesn't correspond exactly to mind, and it doesn't correspond exactly to soul, then there must be something wrong with that definition. And so then we're into this whole mental idiocy of thinking that we know something because we have formulated a definition. We don't know anything when we formulate a definition. You can call it anything you want, and it doesn't mean you know anything except the definition that you've formulated. So this is where Bergson destroys the Aristotelian system. He says, only by an intuitive identity with the being of the thing itself can you know something. And everything else is just your mental conceptions.
And still, according to this definition that we just made, on every level of evolution, there were definitions which were true to that system to endure, to create a habit, and to start a life of its own in the future, a new definition. So in a way, all of them have particular truths, and they have this...
You think that by giving that schematic, we know anything about evolution?
But we know something. that what you define?
We know that definition that I've given. That's all we know.
But he gave a definition, it's of this time.
But that's not what it is.
Yes, for today. But for that time, it was a discovery.
If you become aware of what it really is, gnostically, it's not going to be anything like what we have defined.
Yes. And still, we are talking about philosophy of evolution.
That's what we're talking about. So, this we know. Now we have defined many aspects of what we call the philosophy of evolution. That's exactly what we've done. And it explains conceptually certain relationships, certain patterns, certain historical developments in thought and in science, and from all of that we hope that we touch, we ignite a need to transcend all of that and enter into a direct resonance with the thing itself, the process itself, of which we are a part, but a very small part.
In a sense, it starts from a problem that in the past religion developed idea of God separated from the world, separated. We are different, God is different. And only few had idea of immanence, presence inside, exactly. But now evolution is immanent in us and seen as a God also, divine evolution. So to coincide all in one system, you have to abandon the mind, you have to go out.
And the concept of God also. And Bergson's deconstruction of Aristotelianism begins with the deconstruction of religion. And for him, the whole intellectual development has grown out of social religious structures, but he recognizes that periodically throughout that history there have been true mystics, just as there have been in the 20th century. And he says those people break through all of those forms and bring in the power of love and transcendence, and they use those structures, but they also negate those structures. So this conception was absorbed by Christianity, and for 1,000 years, medieval Christianity, based itself on this Aristotelian conception of God. It left behind the Christ mysticism. The church left behind the Christ mysticism for the most part, and it became this abstract notion of a divine out there who is the cause of everything here. And this made science possible. And Descartes stepped right into the gap there, and the whole scientific civilization grew out of this Christian assimilation of Aristotle.
But it was only possible when Christianity was defeated by Protestant, and it has split and its creed was changed.
So that's on a symbolic level, we see evolution in action. You know, and we see the evolution of mind in action. And so our course is called Mind and Supermind. So now, for the next couple of weeks, 3 weeks, whatever is left, we will consider that we have understood mind and its evolution to some extent, and its involution in all the different levels. And we will undertake to grasp to some extent what supermind might be.
I found a new notion for me, which says an theological explanation and not an atheistical explanation, and that's an interesting construct that you can deny theological explanations without denying God.
Yeah, that's exactly Bergson's point. And I would really recommend that everyone reads at some time in your life his last book, which follows directly from his major book, which we reviewed in the first session. The major one is called Creative Evolution, but the last one is called The Two Sources of Morality and Religion. And it's not about morality and religion, it's about evolution. And it is unbelievable how close he comes to Sri Aurobindo. You know, if you think he was coming close in Creative Evolution when he said consciousness will eventually conquer death, 1907, in this book, in 1931, he is describing exactly what Sri Aurobindo is doing. It's extraordinary, his intuition. And it's just a mental intuition, but it's absolutely accurate. It was like they were on the same track, but like I was telling Keka, it was like Sri Aurobindo is going full on in this direction, and here's Bergson, you know, on the track, just sort of being carried part of the way, while that force is just pumping away all the time, you know. But he was definitely tuned in to the same wave at a certain level. Not the whole spectrum, but at a very high level, he was completely in sync. And that book is an absolute proof of that statement. Anybody can read it and see exactly what I see in it. It's not an interpretation. It's every word, you know, which is just right there. Right there with the life divine, right there with the process of evolution, right there with the descent and integration of the new force. It's just everything is totally attuned. And he got a Nobel Prize for it also. So some people were aware that he was saying something important, even though it, in the meanwhile, got completely lost. And it's about evolution. So it's quite an interesting book. I highly recommend it. Sheldrake is also fun, but ultimately doesn't have the answer.